I believe this is probably the longest anecdotal in the history of the club, and I apologise for that. It's gone over 3 months. I did sort of let out a few of the family secrets at the last one about everyone going to jail in the family except me. So we've actually moved on to 1963, where I transferred to Port Adelaide Ambulance Division. And the reason for it, I was only about 18, or just under 18, and I desperately wanted to do ambulance transport. Where I'd been previously before was basic first aid at Henley Beach Casualty Room and, you know, trots and Anzac days and that sort of thing. So at the age of 18, I found myself attending a multitude of motor vehicle accidents, maternity cases, and during my very young years, found that between Port Adelaide and in the next ensuing 4 or 5 years, delivered some 16 babies in my own time. Port Adelaide was a great learning area. It was a time that the port was considered to be pretty rough, but to me it was a great basis. It was a place to level yourself out, and I attended a number of assaults and murders, and probably the most memorable being the murder of the publican at the Hendon Hotel. We got called down there about 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, and this was in the days of 10 o'clock closing and so on, and the pub was empty. And I walked in, and I had an old fellow with me. Well, old fellow, he was old by my standards. A fellow called Johnny Ryan. He was my driver, and I found this guy lying on the floor, and he was obviously not going too well. He'd been shot, so we put him on a stretcher, and I started resuscitation. And those days, we went on to Queen Elizabeth Hospital. The police later on, I had to go to court and give evidence, and unbeknownst to me, the guy that had actually shot him was watching us doing it the whole time. But when you're 18, you have no fear. It doesn't occur to you that there's any possibility of danger. And that was the same with the shipping at the port. We had a lot of international shipping in those days. We'd go on board to ships with people who had mental health issues, and they were quite dangerous. But, you know, again, at 18, it was just a great thing. The other thing that I found myself doing at that young age was transporting deceased persons to the city mortuary. The city mortuary in those days was an absolutely dreadful building on West Terrace at the front of the cemetery. And I got to know many of the staff there over the ensuing years. But one of the great stories that was to come out of it, there was a Dr. Dwyer that was the pathologist there. And there was another guy who I got to know very well, a fellow by the name of Peter Coolling, who was the coroner's sergeant. And he told me the story one very, very hot Saturday morning. They'd brought in a deceased person who had been decomposing for some time, and Dr. Dwyer felt, well, this isn't such a good way to spend Saturday morning. So they did the autopsy, and then he said to Peter, turn the fans on. So they turned the fans on, and the odour went straight across the road to the Elephant and Castle Hotel. And he said that Harry Dwyer used to come out, he'd have a look, and he'd see the publican standing at the front waving his fist because all the customers had gone. And then Peter and Harry and all the boys would run over the road and have a bar to themselves and a drink. And that is a true story. I wouldn't lie to you. The other thing down the port that I did come across was, and it was a wonderful experience, I had my first encounter with wharfies and Indigenous people. I look back with embarrassment on the way we in Australia treated Indigenous people. I remember one particular hotel opposite the town hall that we used to go to, and there was the white man's bar at the front, and there was a black fella's bar at the back, and the bar didn't have any floor. It was just covered in sand. And I think when I look back on it now, how appallingly we treated those people. The wharfies were wonderful people. And I did a bit of moonlighting just after I turned 22. I worked for a private ambulance service run by the Federation of Waterside Workers. And I could make more on working on a Saturday night than I could for the whole week for the SAM or St. John Ambulance. And often we'd get called to the various wharves to treat the wharfies. And when I got back to the depot, I'd open the back of the ambulance to clean the floor or something. There'd be a parcel and there'd be a crate of oranges, or they fall off the back of trucks and trips, and that was just their way of thanking you for their doing it. I also have a set of American jumper leads, which I shall be forever eternally grateful. But they were wonderful people, colourful, but they set for me a standard of learning about people with different backgrounds. During this time, I might tell you that I was completing between the ages of 16 and 20, I was working as an apprenticeship as a printer with advertising newspapers. Originally, it was a company called Thornquest Press, run by a family group, and it was. I hated printing. I didn't want to do it anyway. I was that bad. They gave me a delivery truck, and I used to run around the last couple of years of my apprenticeship delivering parcels. That was more fun. So in 1968, I married Mary, and as a result, two girls evolved that, Regan. Some of you may know Regan and her husband, Scott Bittner. Scott's a stock agent down here now. And Bridget, she went away. She went overseas, and she met a fellow by the name of Johnny Hull. He's a petrochemical geologist. And they said to us, Dad, you know, we're not going to get married. And I said, that's good, that's fine. You know, new age, we'll live with all that. And they went over to Edinburgh, and Johnny was doing a degree at the Edinburgh University. And somehow or other, they went to Spain and they climbed a mountain. And Johnny suffered a bout of oxygen deprivation and proposed marriage. As a result, my plans for an early retirement went down the drain as we struggled our way through that. But it was, and I'm very glad to have him in the family. At 21, I joined St. John Ambulance Service full time, and that was again the beginning of another era. I started working at Hindmarsh in those days, the old Hindmarsh station, and I managed to work in every metropolitan station in the town. When I was about 23, 24, I spent a couple of years working in the old radio room, which was a dreadful old building stuck up in the middle of a wall. But it introduced me to a lot of people that I would never have met, especially people in the media. And I can remember great characters like Murray Nickell and John Doherty, just to name a few. Brett Bailey was another one. They were all what they call police roundsmen. And just before they closed the Advertiser down, or the News as it was in those days as well, they'd bring me up the night editions of the paper plus a pie and a Coke, which sort of explained some of my bonniness as I got older. I enjoyed this particular time of my life immensely. During those years of working in Metropolitan Adelaide, a young bloke, you don't think a lot about what you are doing. You saw some horrific things. I saw, you know, the Wasleys train smash. You might remember that, some of it was one of the biggest train smashes ever in Adelaide. The other one was the cherry pickers went over the cliff at Norton Summit. I was involved with that. So there were a number of things that happened, and one can talk about it. So in 1979 or 78, late 78, I was asked to go to Narracourt to relieve for 3 months. I came up here full of vim and fire because I knew everything. I was about 32 or 33, couldn't be told anything. I knew most of what I was going to do. And I came up here and I thought, well, this isn't a bad sort of spot. I'll stay here. And I said to Mary, would you like to come up here? I said, if you come up here, you're going to have to do one thing. You're going to have to share answering the phones and radios. They put a phone and a radio in our kitchen. And when I'm out in the road and when I'm not here, you're going to have to answer the phone. Yeah, she said, I'll do that. We did that for some 12 years, and as did the other wives of the full-time. So there was only one at the time, a fellow called Kim Hutchinson, and Kim and Susie were just wonderful people who I've still maintained as friendships today. And then I had another guy come along by the name of Phil Lawson, and Phil also had to do that, and he was another great character in my life. Mary and the kids often sat up to the early hours of the night to manage our phones and radio calls from our kitchen, and to them, they weren't allowed to go to school the next day and talk about anything they'd seen. And I got to say that having come up here with this attitude, well, I knew most of everything, there were some things that happened that were absolutely extraordinary. There were significant events. I was unprepared for the road fatalities. And I think from 1979 to 83, there was something like 33 fatalities. And my colleagues would contact me from Adelaide and say, what are you doing, Denny? What is going wrong? It was an extraordinary time, and a time that I look back with great sadness, because it was just something we couldn't handle as a group. But I'll talk a little bit about that later. There was also the combined crewing of men and women, and occasional female crews only going to assaults and brawls and fatalities. And I got to say that what I loved about Narracourt, there was one particular assault at a pub one night, and there was a blue going on about six blokes, and two girls went, and I'm thinking, I shouldn't send these girls. I shouldn't be sent. Anyway, it's not my problem. Just let them go. And when they got there, they stopped the blue, and everyone pulled the dead and the dying and the injured out, put them in the ambulance, and the girls, and then they continued the blue. And that's what they did for all of us. They were lovely, lovely fights, a little bit different from the port days. But that didn't happen often, but it did. I also have to say about the commitment of the volunteers. In those days, we had a division of some 40 to 45 people, and they were mainly farmers and people who we conned out of hotels, people that would walk past that I thought would look good in uniform. They sometimes didn't have the qualifications that we would all desire, but they were great people. And their only thanks in those days was a barbecue and a couple of drinks at Christmas. Sometimes we had Christmas four or five times a year, but it was still, they were happy to enjoy that time of Christmas. And they were just wonderful, wonderful people. And I've got to say that the community support was phenomenal. Donations from people that gave to us, like all the service clubs, Apex Lions, Rotary, all those sort of people, and ladies, we had our own ladies auxiliary, and we used to have people come into the ambulance station and say, look, I want to leave something for the ambulance in the will, and there were numerous people that did that, and for that I will never forget that sort of generosity and kindness. There was one other thing that happened that had never happened in my life, was working with the opposite sex. I worked in right up until 1978 in Adelaide. It was an all-male, so I think we had one female ambulance officer. When I came here, I met these formidable women, Glad McTernan, Mari Manser, Bev Luff was another one. I remember her and I going to Adelaide to deliver this newborn baby one day and so on. And these ladies, I had a bit of difficulty. I was a male chauvinist to a degree, perhaps. I don't know. I think that's how they viewed me anyway. But they were great, the girls, and there were so many of them, so numerous to mention, but it worked out a wonderful thing. And of course now the girls in the ambulance service are just part and parcel of it. I won't go into too much about the development of the trauma team. I mentioned earlier about the number of traumas that we were having, and I've got to say that the early days of the doctors of Tomo and John Latham, Dr. Vithy and people like that, they used to come out with us, but we didn't really have a structured system. We'd ring them up and say, look, there's been a terrible accident out, can you meet us out there? And they'd come out there. Well, you've heard, I think, Dr. Norcock talk to you about the team as it formalised later on down the years. I think the great thing that the medical profession here in Narracook did was to reduce the number of deaths in our community purely and simply by their presence in those, and that started the early days with those guys who were kind enough to do it. So local doctors played a significant part. One of the great things we did, of course, was to form that trauma team, and we had some wonderful priests and ministers. We decided we needed some people to give some sort of support. There were no sort of social workers or people that would go out to terrible traumas and prangs and whatever, and people would be brought back. And the hospital were flat strapped in those days. They had limited staff. So we got the priest and the ministers involved, and we had them from all denominations. Wonderful fellow called Alex Stevens from the Lutheran Church, who was one of the, like my family was a wonderful bookmaker. He could work out bets and pay, he was a wonderful fellow. And I remember one night we all got invited and told to put up our uniforms. We're going to the induction of the Bishop of the Murray at the Anglican Church. And Alex ran a book on how long his sermon would go. And you're not going to believe it, he won it. But anyway. And Roderick O'Brien put on a dinner beforehand. That was something else again. But they were wonderful. We also had wonderful support from Royal Adelaide, Flinders ICU and people like that. And of course, as Brian said, they got national recognition. We also, for the first time, I think, did audits of cases where we had police, fire, ambulance, and those sort of people, actually coming on and looking at every case we did and saying, well, how can we do it better? Can we improve on this? And I think we did. And we did improve outcomes and reduce the mortality. And another great thing we had, we were the first ambulance service through the generosity of this community to put mobile phones in ambulances. And I can remember doctors at the scene of the ambulance where we used to have to wait to bring them into the hospital to get treatment. They could actually ring the RFDS direct or ring the Royal Adelaide Intensive Care and do a clinical assessment of the patient, and by the time we'd actually extricated the patients from the cars, the air ambulance would be on its way down here. So in 2001, it was time for me to hang up the stirrups and get out. I spent the next few years working as a state duty manager. I just want to tell you one quick story, because I know a lot of you are on the farm, but I again said to you how I thought I knew everything. I got called to a job one day off of Lock Arbor Lane where a guy had got his leg caught in a post hole digger. I rolled out there and I think I had Kim Hutchins with me, and I looked at it and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't understand how post hole diggers work. This guy, and I think he was Polish, so he was like a contract worker, and he'd been there by himself and he looked bloody awful, and I didn't know what. I thought, what am I going to do? I don't know how. We were very reliant on Country Fire Service in those days to come out and work these things out. So that's problem one solved, but it's going to take, you know, 20 minutes to get that solved, and then I'm worried about this guy's condition. I rang Brian Norcock, and he came in. In the meantime, I sat in the dirt with this guy, and we smoked a packet of Icount. That seemed the best treatment at the time, not just for him, but for me. Because I'll never forget this guy, his bravery and strength in it. And when Brian Norcock eventually got out there, we got him back into hospital, and he said he was probably minutes away from death. I always put it down to the Viscount saving his life. Anyway, as I say, for the last 5 or 6 years of my life, I spent travelling around as state duty manager, working with the government radio network. It was, again, a chance to see other sides of ambulance service. It will never beat Narracourt. Narracourt was sensational, and the people in it. And I pay tribute to it was particularly the Country Fire Service, to our local doctors and those sort of people. I wanted to just conclude this discussion briefly that in 2006 I retired after 39 years full-time service. And I've got to say, the ambulance officers today, what I started off just doing basic first aid, today it's a three-year university course. You're getting the best service available. You're getting you're getting that better clinical qualification there. We have a problem at the moment with the ambulance that if you're a subscriber to the ambulance, you only get covered in South Australia unless you take out a statewide thing. I've only just found that out recently. And I would urge anyone that's got health funds and you think to yourself, oh, well, I'm covered Australia-wide with my health funds, check. Because if you haven't got Australia-wide coverage, often the health funds do nothing more than cover you for an emergency call. And I had a gentleman ring me only a few weeks ago where his old mum was taken from Kingston to a private clinic for x-rays in Mount Gambier. They got their first bill as they took him from the hospital from the Kingston Hospital to Mount Gambier. It was $1,360. And they waited a half an hour and then brought it back, and that was another $1,360. And it wasn't covered by private health funds. I urge you to check your private health funds to make sure you are covered. The other thing I would urge you to do as we get older is to call an ambulance when in doubt. There's no charge. They'll come to you at any time and just make sure you're okay. It's better than in my day, because if I'd come with you, I might have had somebody like Father Milburn on board, and that often used to frighten the Catholics in the town when the family would get out. And the other thing is that when you get older, beware of the medication that we're on. One of the great things that we seem to be always doing in the middle of the night was taking people to hospital with broken hips, because you know what we're like, boys. We wake up in the middle of the night, we want a wee, we jump out of bed, and the first thing we do is trip over our pyjama pants and fall over and break our hips. So the word is sit on the edge of the bed, get your bearings, and then go out and make sure your pyjama pants are up. I've got to tell you one quick story, because my friend Kevin Carraher has been giving me hell about my religious beliefs. I've mentioned to you about the family going to jail and all the rest of it. That's fine, that we had to come out in the open about that. But I felt that I was vindicated at one stage, because in 1979 I went to my first ever Narracourt Cup. And I went into the betting ring to place a bet, and there was Father Milburn, with a bag around him. He was the bag man for John McMain, the bookmaker. And I said to him, my dad and grandpa went to jail for that. He said, yes. He said, they weren't licensed to idiot. Get out of here. So I said, thanks, man. So, in conclusion, I just thank you for the joy of being a member of Provis. This has been, you know, probably the second or third greatest thing in my life. You wonderful blokes. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. It certainly has, we've all got some history behind it under our belt somewhere along the line that we can, sometimes we don't want to share it, sometimes we like to share it. Thanks, Peter. Just to